Meeting of the Education Committee will come to order. We do have a quorum.
Hey, very good.
And we have several bills on the agenda, and talk about our disposition of them as we go along. Senator Han, well, Senator Han isn't here. Is bill number one. Who's second?
That's a lesson. Get a second.
Okay. Senator Wolf, we had held over the bill 1690, and there are some issues that people want to be working on, and we thought that rather than attempt to pass that out today, we'd like to see people work through and see if they can get some resolution to this before we take action. I believe the House is taking their bill up on the floor today, and we will watch that, but we'd like to see that we have a fair amount of buy-in in terms of those that are affected by this. So we will not be deliberating on that bill today. Senator Miller, probably. Oh, he's here. Wonderful.
Wonderful.
The world belongs to those who show up. So. this bill is actually not in the jurisdiction of our committee. It is in capital investment. But Senator Senjum asked if we would have a hearing on it, both for just the particular need that's being identified as well as the policy behind it. So, well, he's too late. Senator Miller.
Yes, indeed.
Okay. We'll hear the bill now, and we may delay the policy discussion after Senator Han is here now, too. But Senator Miller.
Very good. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Today, this afternoon, I'm honored to be here with the folks from the Rushford-Peterson School District, and the discussion that will be had is on the Cooperative Facilities Grant, and I look forward to that discussion after our presentation. But with that said, I'll hand it over to the superintendent and his crew for the presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson Olson and members of the committee this afternoon. My name is Chuck Ehler. I'm the superintendent at Rushford-Peterson. So thank you for this opportunity to present our case, tell our story, particularly of our compelling need that we have in the school district. With me today is our chairperson, Angela Colbinson, and a board director, Greg Smith. So I'm excited to have them with us as well.
Thank you. Welcome.
Peg, are we ready to show the video?
You guys ready?
We're going to show a short video here, and it gives you an idea of the school situation that we're dealing with.
If they were able to get downtown, there wasn't very much of the downtown that was still above water.
You know, all the businesses were shut down, so some of them were able to get going again. Some were not.
And it's still a long ways to go as far as financial recovery for our community.
You have to have jobs, and only some jobs were replaced. So
whenever it starts to rain or it rains heavily, even still, now you can see the kids' anxiety levels going up.
This is the story of the irreparable damage sustained by the Rushford-Peterson's public school system from a natural disaster. Part of the building has wood pilings, and all of the building is built on a foundation of sand. The great flood unsettled the foundations of the building. It is evident in every corner of the complex.
Whenever a foundation is compromised on a building such as it is with ours right now, we see lots of different things going on. Walls shifting, floors settling, ceilings settling. The building is shifting and therefore causing these materials to crack and break away from the original surface.
Luckily, no one was here, but you can imagine what would have happened if this had hit someone.
The secretary beyond me and the other office came running, thinking I'd dropped something or fallen, but actually a large piece of plaster had fallen onto the ceiling and plaster dust covered my desk.
Mostly I hear it. I hear it falling from the floor above and landing on the panels in the ceiling.
Well, and I go back to my storage rooms that I have, and there's a wall that if you touch the bricks, it just crumbles right in front of your eyes. You can keep on touching, and it'll keep on crumbling.
And the raw sewage level left a mark here on our doors.
There's continuing problems with mold and odors. I know staff people are affected by the mold.
The school's heating and air circulation system was horribly inadequate before the flood. And even though the building was exhaustively cleaned, the thought of children breathing air from the porous recesses of that basement without adequate ventilation is an ongoing concern. You would think the citizens of Rushford-Peterson School District would have fixed these problems by now, but they've got a lot on their hands. The city of Rushford is still recovering from 17 inches of rain. Stricken that day were banks, clinics, drugstores, dental offices, restaurants, the post office, police and fire stations, city wells, and the wastewater treatment center. In addition, roughly 490 of 766 homes and businesses were damaged or destroyed when two-thirds of the city was covered by flood water.
As a result of the flood, our free and reduced numbers increased from 37% to 58%, and our current levels still maintain around 47%. We lost 13 students and families that moved away and directly impacted us financially to the tune of about $160,000 per year.
This is not a property-rich community, so there's no easy way to distribute the cost of a new facility. The citizens of Rushford-Peterson School District can't handle a 48% increase in their local debt service. Taxes on a $100,000 house would increase by $346 and as much as $748 on a house valued at $175,000.
A lot of people had money left to pay on that house. Now you add a minimum of $50,000 more onto that mortgage, and that's a burden.
Rushford-Peterson isn't asking the state to cover the entire cost of the building. What they need is help with costs associated with replacing a structure that was devastated by a natural disaster. The board is preparing to ask the residents of the district to cover a third of the cost of replacing the building complex. We recognize that we must be willing to do this before we would ask the state to commit.
We are number two on the Minnesota Department of Education's bonding priority list. And we're happy that the legislators and governor recognize the need for us to have use of the Cooperative Facilities Grant. Our goal with our new school initiative is to provide economic stability to our region, as well as to provide a bright future for our families, our children, and our staff members here, as well as all the communities involved in the Rushford-Peterson School District.
Thank you very much. May I just ask a question? When you said the community, you needed to bring forth a community commitment, has that been voted and approved by the community residents to do the one-third, or is that outstanding as well? Superintendent.
Chairperson Olson and committee members, we made that recommendation to the Minnesota Department of Education when we were in the process of filling out the Cooperative Facility Grant, and they recommended and told us that statute would not permit us to do that. So I have included in your packet this afternoon, and I apologize for how it may look. We put this together this morning at school at 6:30. I promised my secretary I'd make coffee at 5:45, so we were putting this together. But the Cooperative Facilities Grant is mentioned in here. It's on like page 3 of the document. I apologize again. There's no page numbers on it, but just near the front is the statue of the Minnesota Cooperative Facilities Grant. It's 20. The number there is 123A.442, and it lists some of the criteria qualifications for that. And again, it's not all inclusive of the statue, but it's there for you to make reference to.
Madam Chair?
Senator Reeder.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a very good, you know, presentation on, you know, what happened. But I just have a curiosity. I was on a school board. I know Senator Hand and perhaps others, and we, as part of our obligation as board members, would ensure risks and take out policies. Was there a policy that you had taken out as a school board and in anticipation of various risks or perils that might occur?
The school district did have flood insurance, and that was to the amount of $25,000. That's the only dollar amount that we had to cover our losses. We were very fortunate, very blessed to have FEMA work with us in a very cooperative manner. Our cost and loss were in the neighborhood between $780,000 to $1 million worth of loss to our school district. And FEMA, again, worked very cooperatively, and we were very successful in making use of their dollars.
Mr. Nauman, I know that we were going to discuss policy-wise perhaps a bit later here, but can you has this been used recently?
Madam Chair and members, in your packet today, I have prepared a spreadsheet that looks back at the history of the use of the Cooperative Secondary Facilities Program. It has been a number of years, Madam Chair, is the answer to your question. We have 5 previous occasions. It's a spreadsheet. It might be helpful for members to know that school districts become eligible to participate in this program if 2 or more school districts get together and submit a joint application, or the district is a consolidated school district after the date of July 1, 1980. And this district qualifies because they meet that test. I know there's another bill that's been introduced for United Cell Central, and they also meet that test. The year approved is the year that the legislature approved the money. And at the time, for example, taking the first one, the ACGC High School project was approved in the 94 bonding bill, and it was in anticipation that those 3 school districts, Atwater, Cosmos, and Grove City, were in the process of a consolidation. There was a restriction in the bonding bill in that particular year for a joint powers agreement. $6 million was appropriated. The funding source was the state bonding. There's the legal citation. And I think it's worth noting that the districts eventually did have an effective year consolidation in 95. So that works across the data that's presented in this spreadsheet. But that was the most recent.
Okay. Well, I think we do have a more extensive discussion that we need to have on the cooperative facilities aspect of it. But is there anything more that you would like to share in terms of this particular? It's quite obvious that you have a very real need. But the amounts, even that you look at, that were bonded for when you were talking 6 and 8 million, but you're going up to 28 million is quite a different leap, too.
Correct. In order for us to be successful in our project, we have worked with RCS Consulting, and they have been with us since shortly after the flood and have advised us all the way through the whole process. And so that's part of the requirement of the Cooperative Facilities Grant, is to come up with projected costs for the project. Chairperson Olson, if I may, I'd just like to follow up the video, if I could, with just a couple of things for show and tell this afternoon, if the committee is receptive to that. Mm-hmm. In the video, they mentioned this falling plaster, and this is from our 1906 construction, and this is the plaster that we're talking about. And it is a part of the main structure, and as one of the teachers mentioned in the video, it's that constant sound that you hear on there. And that's what we're making reference to. And we have had to remove some of this, but it's difficult to find all of those areas. So we still have this going on. And the fibers you see that are sticking out on the side of this, you probably can't see them where you're at, but there are fibers sticking out. This is not asbestos. This is horsehair. They used that to bond the plaster back in 1906 when the building was constructed.
So that was close to the time of the Capitol being
yes.
built as well.
And you can probably relate to some of the other issues. This is an example of one of the water pipes that we recently had break. This was supplying our hot water to the kitchen. And we come in one morning and no hot water, and this is what we're enduring. You can see the rust that is formulated on our pipes. And as a result of that, we have this type of issues that we're constantly compelled to deal with. In addition to that, when they mentioned air quality issues, and this is a sewer pipe. This is a sewer pipe that it takes the smell out of the sewer, out of our building to the rooftop. And as you can see, this one was completely rusted off. And it is one of the reasons why we're saying to you as a committee today is that our need is compelling. It's great. And we are hopeful that you will recognize that need today. In addition to that, I have included in your packet today my testimony and will not go over that verbatim, but I just want you to know that we have received the endorsement and the support of the Rochester Post Bulletin. There's an article near the back with an editorial that talks about our need and the fact that they is a paper that supplies our community and the southeast area. They felt compelled to make our need known as well. And at this point, I'd like to just turn it over to Board Chairperson Angela Colbinson for her to say a few words.
Say your name for the record. Welcome.
Thank you, Chairperson Olson and members of the committee. My name is Angela Colbinson. I am a mother of two. I have a third grader and a two-year-old daughter that attends the early childhood program in one of the rooms that you saw that has the sewage on the door. I guess I have a whole testimony, and I will not read through it all. You can do so at your leisure. The things I want to stress is that you guys are our only hope. And if we had other ways of getting a new school building, we'd be knocking down that door and beating it every day. You are our last chance, and we're getting to the point where we're at the midnight hour of our school building. Our foundation is shifting. Everybody struggles with old buildings. We have an old building, and several problems go along with that. We also have a natural disaster. We have significant damage from that, and that continues to play a part. Even though it was in 2007, we still have problems today that we're coming across that our foundation is moving. We're having decrease or shift in floors are sinking. Just as a parent, I would want to share with you that I'm afraid to send my kids to school every day. I'm also afraid to wake up one day and we'll have the next I-35 bridge disaster, and it'll be in Rushford, Minnesota. So those are the things that I struggle with, and I welcome any ideas that you may have for us to help this keep moving forward, and I appreciate your time today. Thank you, Chairperson Olson and members of the committee.
Thank you.
Also with us, Chairperson Olson and committee members, is Board Director Greg Smith. And before Greg speaks, I want to lay a little foundation for what he's going to be talking about today, and that's the tax impact to our community. If we were to go out and fund this project for ourselves, it would mean a 48% increase in our tax impact for the community, which would give us the largest impact in the state of Minnesota. Even by going out and asking our residents for the $9 million to supplement, we're looking at a 17% tax increase or tax impact. That would put us in about the middle of the pack as far as communities that they keep track of those that have tax impact. Board Director Smith is involved, heavily involved in agriculture, and can speak to you from the taxpayer's viewpoint here this afternoon.
Thank you. Madam Chair and committee members, I'm Greg Smith. I graduated at this school, an 81 graduate. I've lived in the community, lifelong community member. We're a dairy hog and crop farm. We employ about 30 people, so the district is important to us, not only for our employees, kids, and it's the hub of our community. And I work with a lot of landlords. We rent a lot of land, also own land, but I feel our landowners can tolerate a portion of this, but we certainly can't tolerate the whole thing. And I think the facilities we have is to the point where I've heard the expression new facilities or no facilities, and I don't think we can remodel what we have. I don't think we can, and we have to start at the foundation because we got foundation issues. And I'm also on the board for the local elevator, and we're struggling. We have some facilities that got foundation issues, and we just had some issues with the viability of some of our facilities that we already mudjacked once. So I think it's very important to our small town to get some help to keep going. So I want to thank Senator Olson and the committee members for allowing me to speak.
Thank you. Thank you. Are there questions that any of you have?
Chairperson Olson, if I may, I would just like to close with one other statement. In your packet today is a funding rationale for our school district. It's the second page in. One of the questions that gets posed to me is, and one of the fears of you as senators and also representatives of the House, is that you would be setting a precedence by funding our request. And I can tell you from our standpoint is that, as you heard about other communities that have taken advantage, although that was some time ago back in the early 1900s, we feel that because of our unique and compelling situation, the need is definitely there, and we hope that you would recognize that. I would ask you to read through our rationale and to support our initiative. Thank you for your time. We would be happy to answer any questions that you may have in addition to our presentation this afternoon.
Great. Are there any questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Reher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wonder if you could amplify a bit more on the indoor air quality. I did read the one of the stories in the Post Bulletin, and it talked about a student who was having trouble breathing because of the mold, and it seems that the district stipulated that there is that respiratory problem. I don't know if you're on notice for any claims, but I recall just in terms of the state, when we studied this about 10 years ago and Eric Nauman staffed it, we had over $4 billion in building needs and over $1 billion just on the indoor air quality issue. In fact, I think the largest percentage was in Senator Tomasoni's area of the state where the buildings are the most mature. But on the indoor air quality, are there students still in this area where you have a student who's has respiratory problems?
We thank you, Senator Weir, and members of the committee. This is a situation that we monitor constantly. We work with a company or environmental company out of the Southeast Service Co-op, and they're at our school district, and that's something that we monitor, and they work with us. But we did recently just have our wrestling team is practices in our lower level, and because of some health issues experienced by the wrestlers, we had to discontinue practice in that area. And again, it's just a matter of making sure that we can get proper air circulation into our facility. And it's a concern that we have, and we're addressing it, and we try to monitor that as closely as possible to make sure there aren't other health issues being encountered because of it. Thank you for your question.
Any other questions? I just got Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to go on the record to say that I am not in agreement with those who don't want to be in the record on supporting schools and getting bonding money for the schools. I think the opposite. This is exactly what we should be doing, and we should be on record to say that this is our top priority. So I think that Senator Miller is doing a great thing by bringing this to our attention. We have many problems with schools infrastructure, and we need to rebuild so many schools in this state, and we need money to do it. So I commend you for bringing this to our attention and being so descriptive about the condition of your building. I think we need to do more to increase revenue to fix all of these old buildings that we have all over Minnesota. So I think this is a great opportunity for us to start.
Thank you, Senator. Appreciate that.
Thank you, Senator. We do not have the bill before us, which is the reason we will not be taking action. It is in another committee's jurisdiction, but they asked us to at least hear the case, and maybe whether they will request such an action or recommendation from us, I'm not certain at this point, but they also to discuss the policy issue, because it does have some broad implications, and I think we do need to. We have a responsibility to deal with that as well. This is maybe slightly unrelated, but as I recall, last time I was in Rushford, I visited a business that made LEFSA. Did that survive?
Yes, it did. In fact, had I known, we would have brought you an ample supply this afternoon.
Well, I'm actually Swedish rather than Norwegian, but my Norwegian friends were, totally addicted to it. But I could have handled one.
Well, we'll certainly keep that in mind the next time we come up.
No. You don't need to.
No bribing.
I don't want you bribing. Okay. Attempting to bribe anybody. So you've got enough challenges on your hands.
Yes, we do.
So thank you very much for this presentation. And we will hear Senator Hand's bill, but then we're going to come back and have some policy discussion, and Eric Nauman will explain a little further of what's happening here. And if you're able to stay and want to listen to some of that you're certainly welcome.
Again, Chairperson Olson and committees of the member committees here, thank you for your time this afternoon. Thank you for listening to our story and taking an interest in our unique and compelling situation at Rushford Peterson Schools.
Thank you.
Senator
Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I apologize. I know you called our bill earlier, and we were doing some last-minute clarification of this issue, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I hope this will be relatively brief and not too complex. This is Senate File 1160, and I would like to offer an author's amendment, and I don't know if Council has distributed those. Which amendment are you going to distribute? Yes, that would be fine.
Okay.
And I'm going to turn over the testimony here to the proponents of the bill.
This is an author's amendment, and I think we have plenty of people here. We don't need to digest the amendment. It's getting it in the form you wish. So Senator Hand moves the A2 amendment. There's no discussion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, I want to divide the testimony of this into kind of two parts. There's really two things you'll notice in the bill, the underlined language. There's some on page one, roughly four or five lines. And then on the second page, the effective date language. And I want to talk about both of those things. And so I would like to turn the testimony over to talk about the substantial change, which is on page one. And we do have a testifier here that's willing to talk about why we're doing this.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Trent Cole. I'm an optometrist, behavioral optometrist in Woodbury, Oakdale, and Cottage Grove area. I'm also a co-founder of the Minnesota Vision Coalition, and I'd like to thank Senator Hahn for representing and bringing this bill forward to you. We're here today to discuss the impact of vision and learning, and an area that is not being addressed as far as what we're concerned is the ineffectiveness of vision as vision screenings in the school district. And the public awareness of what a vision screening and vision examination entail. One thing that we look at is just that vision screenings that we do, a lot of people believe that that's the same as an eye exam. And there's many natures that you cannot pick up in the screen that may be impacting the educational performance of a child. Right now, we know screenings miss up to 60% of kids that have problems with their eyes. We know that 1 in 5 in the schools have a vision problem, whether it be refractive error, eye movement problem, or vision processing problem. And so we believe that by enacting a little bit of language to try to help educate the public is what we're standing for. The best part about it is there's really no cost associated with it, and we believe that it is just a positive thing to do for community awareness to help our kids have the right tools to succeed in the education system. And with that, I have many facts and figures and stats if anybody has any questions regarding why we're bringing this bill forward.
And members, I just want to point out that that language that's underlined, there's a portion that is in quotation marks, and this what the bill suggests is that that language in quotation marks be included in the notice that's provided to parents prior to the screening that happens. And so you can read the language. That's what's being proposed to be put into the notice. I do want to turn the page over to the effective date and just point out, as this bill has been worked on actually starting last year, there have been several changes to it. But in talking with the School Board Association, of course, and being a former school board member, as is Senator Wieger and probably others, there was concern about mandates and paying for things that they wouldn't otherwise have to pay for. And, of course, one of the things, there is a cost to providing notices. And so as a way of addressing that, what the effective date does is say that the bill, the language in the bill, is effective upon enactment. However, it would only apply to notices that would be printed subsequent to the passage of the bill. So if a school district has notices already printed for vision screening that they intend to use in the next school year, they would be permitted to do that under this effective date language. But as they looked at printing additional notices for the next time they were going to do the screening, then they would be required to use the new language. So there should not be additional cost to schools to comply with this particular mandate, which is what it is. But that was the reason why we did that, and I want to point that out. So
thank you, Senator Hand. I suspect that the quotation marks at the end of that on 2.9 are unnecessary and probably should come out.
I'm sorry. Yes, I would. I think so. I'm not sure if there's a
A quotation at the end, but not the beginning. You want to explain that to me? Ah, okay. All right. I stand corrected. We had a quotation. The beginning is at the at 1.3, so there is a. It is appropriate for the quotation there.
Oh, so it's a quotation for the entire.
For the
section.
Entire amendment.
Okay. All right. I got it.
As someone said earlier, you learn something new every day. I'm still learning. Senator Daley. Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Hand. I sort of liked your original bill. Why the change?
Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni, I think partly there was concern that was raised by various practitioners of vision screening, and the original bill had language that was pretty specific about what had to be done, and I think there was some concern about that, and I believe that over the course of the summer there was discussions and compromise was reached, which is represented in the bill. I believe that's correct, and it could be corrected on that. I think that was really the issue.
Is there any practice now that you know, if in fact a child had an eye exam, are schools allowed to accept that in place of vision screening? I mean, is that a current practice that wouldn't really have to be stated in law?
Madam Chair, I believe it is, and there may be others who could point to that. Maybe somebody from the School Board Association knows it, but I believe that is, if you as a parent have taken your child to an eye doctor or something and had an eye exam and bring that in, I don't believe that if you have that, you have to do a vision screening as well. But
there probably will be some testimony on this, and we might get that answered. Thank you. Are there any other questions? You like the other language, Senator Tomasoni? But
I'm not going to make any motions, Madam Chair.
Any further?
But I suppose, Madam Chair, the question should be asked of the witness is the new language sufficient to make sure that we don't miss kids who have eye problems?
Madam Chair and, and Senator, I believe that the language is a good start as far as trying to identify the individuals that are being missed today. Right now we have a 60% error rate, and anything we can do to decrease that error rate would be positive. And I think public education is where we have to start, just so that individuals understand that the screening it needs to be brought to the forefront, that it's not the end-all, be-all, that you have to do more. And just be aware of that, and that the school district is addressing the situation where they say you need to be aware that this is not going to serve as comprehensive eye care for your child, the screening.
Okay. Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, I'm sorry, I missed your name.
Trent. Dr. Cole.
Dr. Colton.
Yeah.
Dr. Colton, so just having gone through this last year, having my child, 3-year-old, then screen, I don't remember getting anything about his vision.
Could
or
you
any
talk into the mic? Yeah, thanks.
I'm just curious, having gone through this the childhood screening with my 3-year-old last year, I don't remember getting any information even saying that he should have a comprehensive eye exam. Is that something that's traditionally done at the pediatrician at his annual checkup? Or I'm just curious, what do you recommend in your professional judgment, that all kids go and get a comprehensive eye exam before they start kindergarten? Now, I don't know if this language is making that clear enough. I mean, just speaking as a parent.
Madam Chair and Senator, you are correct in the form that there are other steps that should be taken to ensure that the child's ocular health is correct for school. I think this bill was proposed as an initial start for public education. There are other states that have taken a little bit farther as far as trying to do more comprehensive nature care prior to entering school, but I think that was seen as a little bit of a roadblock at this time with the state. So our recommendation professionally is that we're part of an infancy program where we can do comprehensive eye exams on six-month-olds, all the way down to six-month-olds. But my recommendation is that everybody should have a comprehensive eye exam by 3.5 to 4 years old before they start the school. So hopefully that answered your question correctly.
It does. Just to clarify then, though, it's not required to enroll in kindergarten, though.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator Rieger.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Colton, when was that survey done where you came to the conclusion that 60% of students had a problem that was not detected?
Just a moment, please. Survey was done.
And as you're looking, Madam Chair,
yep,
I believe law currently provides, as stated at 1.29, the components are to be consistent with the standards of the State Commissioner of Health. And I'm wondering, too, if there might be some regulatory opportunity where the commissioner can address some benchmarks that assure that there is correction taken. But first on your survey, when was that done?
As far as the survey goes, I don't have that exact survey in front of me as far as the date goes, but I can get that information provided.
Senator Hand, did you note in your addressing this issue what the Commissioner of Health might have in that provision that's in the current law? Or
are you talking about the
line 1.29 and 1.30?
I have not consulted with the Commissioner of Health on the on this provision, but we're not changing anything, so I don't believe anything that we're doing in the bill would change that provision.
Now, it's interesting that the next sentence there says a developmental screening program must not provide laboratory tests or a physical examination to any child. A comprehensive eye exam does involve some physical examination. So you're letting parents know that this is something that they may need to do, but that is not it's a current prohibition, actually, in terms of what the screening, the role of the screening is within the school, would seem to me.
Madam Chair, I agree. I think and the school boards may want to comment on this, but I think the idea here was not to require the school districts to become providers or examiners or turn them into healthcare professionals. I think that was a provision to assure that districts were not being expected to fulfill that role. And I think that's appropriate. I don't believe that we want to have the schools to become eye doctors or any other kind of physicians that are giving medical advice. Mm-hmm. I think there is a benefit and a need to make sure that children as they enroll in school are prepared or able to see, at least, to, among other things. But I think there's a reasonable need to assure that that exists, and having a screening to assure that is a good thing. I think the intent of the bill is just to make it clear to parents that having that screening doesn't replace a medical exam that some would recommend that should be done in any case.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Any other further questions?
If not, Madam Chair, I don't know if Dr. Ephraim's here. She often comments on other policy issues, but she's a pediatrician, and she weighs in. I appreciate that.
I didn't see her, nor has she asked to testify that I'm aware of. Is she here?
No.
Okay.
Thank you. Senator Hand?
Madam Chair, I just want to point out to the earlier question on line 1.22, there is a sentence that talks about the notice must inform also the parent or guardian. The child need not submit to the screening program if the child's health records indicate to the school the child has received comparable developmental screening performed within the preceding year. So if parents have taken their children to a eye exam and they were able to say, here's what we did with those within the last year, then they would not be required to do the school screening as well. So that's current law. We're not changing that.
And there's pretty detailed instructions as to what's supposed to be communicated, what isn't. Well, Senator Hand, I presume you want to, what action do you want on the bill?
Madam Chair, I would, I don't believe that this has to be heard in any other committee. I have not been told that, and so I would move that the bill be recommended to pass and sent to the floor.
As amended.
As amended.
Is there any further discussion?
Madam Chair, Senator Hand, I know you've been working with a lot of the providers and other stakeholders. Have audiologists weighed in on this? Because, you know, being able to have adequate hearing is very important as well.
Madam Chair and Senator Weir, no, they have not. And I think you raise a good point, and you and I did have a brief conversation about this the other day, that there may be, and we'll see what happens in the future, people who say, well, maybe we need to make sure that parents know that there are other things. And that may be something we'll have to cross that bridge when we come to it. But no other providers have come and suggested that we include in the screening notices anything that is comparable. So at this point, all I'm aware of is that the vision issue has been raised.
Madam Chair, final point.
Yes, sir.
And the whole goal for the state, I believe, ready for K by 2020 or so, and this is a part of being ready for K, and maybe in the future we might see how this interfaces, because this actually does go on the longitudinal data on the MARS number that we have for the child. Yes, it does.
The screening.
Yes. And it helps us in determining whether, if a child's ready. Certainly this contributes to it, and especially the evidence that you shared about the number of students, if you can't see correctly, that they aren't quite ready yet, and that can lead to a lot of other problems. So I appreciate you bringing it forward.
I haven't asked if there's anybody here that wants to testify on this bill.
I'd like to.
Okay. If not, Senator Hand renews his motion to approve Senate File 1160.
Senator Olson.
Pardon me?
I'd like to speak on the bill. I got some history I'd like to share about screening, if I may.
History?
Yeah, about the screening process and documents I provided to the chair on the, at the House regarding this.
Senator Hand, have you had a chance to visit on...
I have not had a chance, and have not heard about this issue. I have spoken to the potential witness on other issues in the past, but not recently, and not on this issue.
Well, I think the issue before us is what we were acting on rather than necessarily the history at this point. So, Richard, if you would hold that, I'd appreciate it. Senator, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Mm-hmm.
Then let's return to the discussion on some of the policy related to the cooperative school facilities issue. I think for many of us that have been around for a while, this is the one that's got some history, and we haven't been dealing with it for some time because it was put in place, I believe, and Eric can amplify on this, as kind of an incentive to some consolidation. And this is quite a few years after consolidation, like, was it 17 years? And if this is going to continue in place in this way, there's a lot of other consolidated districts that may want us to pick up the tab for, new building construction. And so even though we recognize that need, I think we should examine this policy that is here and is the one that is being pursued in this case, what we might want to do. I don't expect us to resolve that at this point, but I think we need some background, all of us, in terms of updating on it and what its implications are. Mr. Nauman,
so, Madam
I think
Chair,
you're prepared to do that for us.
Madam Chair, I'll do my best. I believe in the packet is a list of school district reorganization 1980 to 2011.
I'm not picking up much from your mic, so could you adjust it a bit, or is it the mic or is it the position?
Madam Chair, can you hear me now?
Yeah, that's very much better.
Senator Hand will forgive me. I think he's out of the room, but I think in the packet is the document from the Department of Education that shows the various consolidations since 1980. It conveniently picks 1980 because the statute in question that we're looking at has a criteria that in order to be eligible, two or more districts have to get together and apply for a secondary facility. A cooperative facility, or you have to have been a consolidated district since the date July 1. And members will probably recall that during the 80s and early 90s, we in Minnesota had a spate of consolidation. So school districts in largely rural Minnesota that were, for a variety of reasons, were acknowledging that it made sense to get together and consolidate into a single district. And the cheat, if you're looking at a school district run, is in most cases they start with a 2 and they have 4 digits. So those are the districts that end up being consolidated districts, 2180, 2384. And as part of that recognition that the consolidation is happening, the legislature passed a variety of incentives to assist that, believing that it made good sense.
Pull that over just a little.
I'm afraid I'll break it if I push it too far. So maybe we'll get to know each other a little.
Yeah.
And this authority for a cooperative secondary facility. I'm sorry, Senator Hamm, my mic is apparently not working.
That's all right.
was passed in the 1988 or so time frame, and it was designed to facilitate districts that were contemplating getting together. In some cases, the need for getting together was a facility. Similar to the story that you've heard today at Rushford-Peterson, that their facility was old, it was falling apart, there were shortcomings with the building, and it made sense to get a new facility. So the state, through this committee, passed law that allowed districts that were working together or consolidated to apply through a process of the Department of Education, and then if funded through the bonding bill, be awarded a grant for
not more than the lesser of not more than $20,000 or 75% of the overall project. So in this case, I believe the project is $28 million. 75.
You said 25,000 or you meant 25?
Million. Did I say 1,000?
Yes.
Oh, my apologies.
That's right.
We, in fiscal staff, we lop off zeros pretty regularly. So the formula is the lesser of $20 million or 75% of the overall cost of the project. So in this case, they're asking for the $20 million because 75% would be 21. So this is the most they're under the law that they're eligible to ask for.
Now, Eric, I understood him to say that when I asked about the local contribution of that 25%, that they were told by the department that they couldn't do that. But you're saying that, that the 25% it was to be a local contribution?
Well, even in this as part of the process in law, I think what the superintendent was implying was that it was out of sequence. I was intrigued by that as well, and I went back and looked at the law. They can't actually go to that. It is required that they go to the voters, but they can't do that step in the process until after having been approved.
Okay.
So it's just out of order.
Okay.
So I think the district would have to, and I hope that I'm getting that right, that that's what you've been told. In fact, they're saying that.
Madam Chair, question on that point?
Senator Bono.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Nauman. So let's say they go to the voters and the voters say no, then even though we've approved it, then the project is null and void, or how does
I believe, that work? I believe that is, in fact, correct. I'm getting smart on this statute in the last couple of days. In fact, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
So I guess the final point that I would offer for the committee to wrestle with is that the list that I prepared earlier not surprisingly, we were having a fair bit of consolidations at the time, and most of the grants that the legislature approved were fairly close in time frame as part of the consolidation. Now, I admittedly wasn't working here at the time, but I think it's an interesting question that if you look at the date when the legislature approved it and when the year the consolidation was effective, and if you acknowledge that to be eligible, you have to be one, a group of two or more districts that are contemplating getting together, or a consolidated district. In other words, you've already consolidated since that July 1, 1980 date. That confines your universe of eligible districts under this grant. And the one at the top of the list, ACGC, got together finally in 1995. The grant was 94. Grant County High School was provided by the legislature in 93. The effective year of the consolidation was 95. You can see there's a fairly tight alignment between that the date of the final consolidation and when the legislature provided the dollars. So I would ask the committee to think about that as a question. The date of Rushford-Peterson's final consolidation, that which makes them eligible, was 1990. And we're a few years past that. And I'm not saying that that's good or bad. I'm just saying that it's an interesting side note. You'll also probably be asked to review a similar request from United South Central. Their consolidation, I believe, was 1993. And we're a few years past that date, too. So it may be there is a policy question that obviously when the legislature created this program in its original instance, it was a tool to facilitate consolidation. Rushford-Peterson is a fair bit past that, and maybe it's something that you want to think about in terms of the overall mechanism, because there may be districts that haven't consolidated that have facilities needs that, unless they get together with another neighboring district, would not be considered eligible for consideration under this program.
So, Eric, it appears that all of the grants that were approved were done. It was done so before the consolidation actually occurred.
Madam Chair, that's what the dates imply to me too.
So that
I have to say that that's
it was definitely an incentive then at that point for the consolidation.
Madam Chair, I believe that's the case. I say believe only because I wasn't here at the time, and I haven't been able to obtain that answer myself. But no. That's certainly what it looks like to me as well.
Now I can't remember if we had any other proposals, and we've had different construction proposals come before our committee over the years. And I've been around too long; they all start, you know, getting in one big lump. Have we had many construction recommendations or proposals that fit this model?
Madam Chair, in the last 15 years, I do not recall one. That's my time reference.
We've had some maximum effort.
We have had maximum. I was just going to go there. You'll remember Red Lake and Net Lake have been participants in the maximum effort capital loan program, which is a little bit different than this one.
Mm-hmm. So how about questions from members? Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Or comments.
Maybe this would probably be best for the superintendent. Do you know the numbers on the maximum effort approach? I mean, is that usually the department runs those numbers, I think, don't they?
Madam Chair and Senator Stumpf, maybe a little help on the operations of that program as well. It's also a capital bonding request. And once approved into that program, a school district then has to levy the maximum effort tax rate and pay back the state. So that's a particular case where there is an effort to make good on the loan that the state extended. Essentially, we're using the state's bonding authority to build a particular school building. Some districts have grown sufficiently. That was the original intent of that program, so that the expanding tax base and the expanding student body of a particular district would generate sufficient revenue to actually pay off the loan. But if in the case of Red Lake, for example, I don't think that most are assuming that that would get paid off. And under the language of the statute, after 50 years, the loan is forgiven.
So is any data or is any exploration taking place as to what impact would that approach, how do your district numbers fit into that model?
Well, thank you for inviting me back up. It's my understanding on that for the maximum effort that we're limited to $2 million. So I may or may not have my facts straight, so I'm not sure. We do work with Ehlers and Associates, and they assisted us in putting the numbers together. So if that is a need by the committee, I would be happy to seek that out and be happy to answer any other questions you may have here this afternoon.
I don't
Madam
have
Chair.
Any recollection of that limitation being $2 million, but it's kind of what your tax capacity is and what the effort has to be. Is it better or worse than what it would be in either of the cases that you've put before us? It's, I guess, what I was just looking for in terms of information. Somebody else had the Senator Stump.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is the $2 million, is that what, when you use the maximum effort against the property, is that what it raises? Is that what you meant by the $2 million?
Yes, and again, I don't want to stand as an expert on this because I haven't done enough research on that to be 100% sure of that. So please be careful on my interpretation of that statute and the limitations that are placed on that.
So you're saying that that would be your local effort is raising $2 million a year or at least under your current valuation?
No, I'm not saying that would be our limit, because obviously our project exceeds that by lots of dollars. So I have to say to you that I don't completely understand, and we'll hope that we can find that answer to your question.
Well, Mr. Nauman, maybe you can refresh. I think maybe a lot of the members aren't familiar with the maximum effort loan program either. And have you? I shouldn't spring that on you.
Well, I sort of, Madam Chair, I sort of thought you might. number one, my recollection is that there is not a limit, and I haven't.
For the size of the project.
Madam Chair, I don't believe so. For example, in my recollection, NetLake received a few years back. Chuck, please forgive me. I'm not sure I've got this exactly right. But a few years back, we extended substantially higher amount than that, than the $2 million figure to Red Lake.
Yeah.
And what the requirement on a school district at that point is to levy, and I believe it's 32% of the adjusted net tax capacity of the district, and impose that and remit that whatever is generated off of that that tax rate to the state to pay back the maximum effort loan, essentially.
And so, and that's not capped at $2 million, is it?
Madam Chair, no, I have not seen that in law. I'm looking quickly here. I don't see that. So I'm not. I guess we'd want to have a conversation with the district to determine where that $2 million comes from.
So, Senator,
Madam Chair, I have another question, a little different subject.
Absolutely.
Okay. So I know recently in Senator Tomasoni's district, or close to his district, Senator Tomasoni.
I'm listening.
Okay, good. Thanks.
No worries.
That several school districts consolidated, and that right now in Cook, there's a new Cook High School that's the culmination of Orr and this one and that one. I don't know which ones came together. No. But so I know that's Senator Bach's district.
That was a St. Louis County School District.
Okay, thank you.
It's so St. Louis County. Mm-hmm. So that wasn't a consolidation.
They did consolidate earlier, but they've been St. Louis County for quite a while.
The district is the St. Louis, yes. County, the whole county.
Right. Well, it's not the whole county. Well,
pretty much.
It goes the whole length of the county, but there's several other school districts within the county.
Okay,
but this one is called St. Louis County, and Orr is one of the
so those three districts that you're referring to just got together within that
no,
district.
What she's referring to is some new schools that are being built.
Okay.
Well, Madam Chair,
okay.
And Senator Tomasoni, as I understand it, schools closed and they came together, and now there's going to be one big school.
Yeah.
And it was done on a bond referendum issue, and it caused a lot of controversy in the community. And I wondered if they ever applied for this program, because I would have thought that perhaps they could have qualified.
No.
Mr. Nauman, do you know, was there any talk of that?
Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff, I'm veering into speculation here quickly. The criteria, one of the primary criteria is a group of districts getting together, agreeing to work together, or a consolidated district since July 1, 1980. If to the extent that it meets that test, I believe it does, they would be eligible. That doesn't mean it makes appropriate financial sense, or that they weighed the likelihood of receiving the dollars as a good choice. I think what you're hearing here from the superintendent, I don't mean to advocate on their behalf, but I think he's suggesting that this is something that they've taken a look at, and they think that it's a good bet for them to come here and ask this committee to hear their circumstance and make a recommendation to the Capital Investment Committee. I think that might be different because they had a larger tax base up north with which to work. It was more likely that they could see the solution for their needs using the normal debt service equalization program.
Thank you.
Well, what Senator Bonoff's talking about, though, Madam Chair, is that
Senator Tomasoni.
Two schools were closed up north and a school down in the southern end of the district was closed. The referendum, you have to understand, was it's about 100 miles long. Most of the tax capacity was in the northern part of the district, and so most of the people in the northern part of the district voted no, but most of the people in the southern part of the district voted yes because they knew the people in the northern part of the district were going to be paying. And so the referendum did pass.
It did.
Yes, and so it's one of these. It wasn't a pretty situation, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, this, I think just from the information you've given us, that the amount that you're looking at with the approximately 25% amounted to 17
0.05% increase in your taxes. Well, increase. That's not necessarily the capacity. If it had to be a certain percentage of the tax capacity, I don't know if...
Madam Chair, if you're...
looking at his book.
I believe that what you might have done is blended two programs.
Well, I'm not on maximum... well,
the maximum
effort relates to the
32% relates to the maximum effort loan program.
Right.
There is no such requirement here for a payback, thus no requirement of a maximum effort tax.
Right, but if there were, how much property tax burden would that put on them in relation to the one they're asking for or willing to? That's what I was trying to see if I could sort out.
Well, Madam Chair, we'd have to run some numbers.
Yeah, and what your total tax capacity is?
I will be happy, Madam Chair, to find that out and share that with you and ask you to share that with your committee as well. So that'll be a question I take back and take it to Ehlers and Associates.
I think that we're going to continue to have some discussion in terms of capital kinds of needs. And we need to understand what tools have been used thus far. And, you know, we may not get it solved this year, unfortunately. But the Capital Investment Committee certainly can, depending on what guidelines they may have for making their decisions. I think you've got your oar in the water, and it's hard to say what would happen. But I think the policy that we have to consider is do we want to lift that? We've never put a deadline on it, and yet it's been there as kind of an incentive to consolidation. If you lift the, if you don't have a deadline, and you don't the consolidations, there's a lot out there that have occurred that may say, you know, have particular needs, and we could have a flood of use of this approach. Is this appropriate? That's what, from a policy standpoint, that we have to determine.
Oh, Madam Chair?
Yes, sir.
We discovered in the bonding committee the other night that we have $1.96 billion worth of bonding capacity this year, so we might be able to do just about all of them.
Well, see, there have been some schools that we have, they have, I think, have we, do we have a history of, have we done any other local or area schools through just straight bonding? It's only been the maximum effort.
Maximum.
Senator Stumpf?
Madam Chair, I think we have the history of the great white elephant out in, I'm not sure what county it is, in western Minnesota. This goes back where there was a consolidation, but it was a new program that was initiated. I remember the conference committee and and the outcome, I think it was out by Wheaton, Minnesota. You know who's, maybe that's Gary Kubley's district.
I remember.
And they
conflicting one. I don't remember the white elephant part.
And the other one, well, it was just a new building that was totally in a new place. And then the other
that
one that I
Atwater,
think might
that was an Atwater Cosmos
no.
Group.
No, I think it was actually kind of sold with the idea of five districts, but I think only about three or two actually got together. But the other one was, I think, in Glenwood.
Okay.
That was a new district. Well, that one might not have been state money, though. The other one was.
Madam Chair, I remember one. In Grand Meadows, there was a dome school. Senator Kenrick Scavel and I actually looked at it and a prototype, but it was to look at some options to conserve energy, and mm-hmm. I believe it's doing well. But it was a dome we had in the bonding bill. I think it was $5 million.
Three.
Well, I don't think we're going to resolve the policy issue, but we've gotten some things. We do have a deadline of ending at 4:30, and I do want you to indulge me on passing this little bill, getting it back onto the floor. But I'll turn it over to you when we get to that point. But perhaps some summary of these are. council and fiscal folks can provide to us, because I think we'll continue to be a part of this dialogue.
Madam Chair,
Senator Bonner.
Just a question. Would we be able to make a change in the statute to say that in the future we really do think it should be like a five-year window or something and still let this one go through kind of grandfathered?
Well, that's one of the options that
okay.
that might be – well, right now you don't have to do anything
right.
unless we want to shut the door.
Yeah.
But
it seems like a good idea to shut the door.
Right now the door is open in terms of eligibility for making that application.
Yeah.
And it's up to the Capital Investment Committee to make that decision. Now, they haven't they wanted us to look at it and look at the policy, but they didn't ask us for any particular recommendation. Mm-hmm. So I'll follow that up, and we may have some further discussion if they are going to press us in that direction.
Miller's on the committee.
So,
Madam Chair,
I just have Senator DeCraig.
One question. Did you mention that you had $25,000 in flood insurance?
Our property insurance covered that amount, and at the time we did not have flood insurance because we weren't considered a risk for flood. Okay. So the property insurance only covered that amount. In fact, I think it's less than that, but I'll get those figures for you as well.
Yours was really a deluge.
Yes. For us, for the school district, obviously you heard about the community, but the school, our lower level, had 6 inches of raw sewage in it, and then the other areas, there were other areas that were inundated with flood water. The dilemma for us and the Minnesota Department of Education was that, and FEMA as well, is that the damage was not extensive enough to declare the building to not be repairable or whatever. You know, that was my first choice. In fact, I made that recommendation, but that fell on deaf ears. So I would like to just follow up with this, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm certainly receptive to if you want to include us in the bonding bill, because our project does meet all the criteria of that. It does specify in bonding bills that it has to be flood mitigation. It does need to address infrastructure. It does need to have an economic stimulus, as obviously this would be for our community. And those are just some of the areas that I know of that are included in the bonding proposal. So if the committee is receptive to that idea versus the cooperative facilities grant, we're all for it. So,
well, Superintendent, that's the case to make before the bonding committee.
Absolutely. We understand that.
And so do go forward with that. And as I said, we don't have the bill. Sometimes we have had the capital bills and they've started at our committee and then we've sent them on. But that is not the case this time, so we really don't have anything to act on. But if they do want a recommendation from us, I guess, you know, we may come back and deliberate on that further.
That would be
thank you. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair and committee members, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity again to follow up.
Very good. Thank you. Then send the gavel down. I have the bill that is on the agenda here, Senate file or House file 873, is one of the ones that was on general orders and was sent back to the committee. And I'm just asking that it be moved and returned to general orders. That it's involving the operating capital provision, some obsolete language. It might as well be frank. It's generally known as a vehicle bill. I mean, we may need it at some point, and that's what we're talking about.
Madam Chair, from a technical perspective, yes. It deletes the obsolete equalizing factor.
The equalizing factor that's
no longer yes. needed.
Okay.
So, Senator Olson, you have a motion to
make. I would like to move that House File 873 be recommended to pass and return to the floor of the Senate.
It's already, as Senator Olson said, it's already passed. So with that, we don't need any testimony. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Motion prevails.
Motion prevails.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, members.
Next meeting?
We've got five minutes ahead of time here.
Not at 5:30.
Meeting's adjourned.
Okay.